On this week's show, discussing BIM reality and construction with Connor Christian from Kiewit. In this week's news, is smart IT the key to the construction industry's ESG journey? And more.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right, Jacob, it feels like I just saw you a minute ago. Maybe it's because I just saw you a minute ago. How you doing, man? It's good to see you.
I'm doing good, man. I'm doing good. You guys are what's in between me and a beer in the weekend. So I'm excited to get this done and then have Connor on the show today.
Yeah, this is awesome. Connor Christian, not new to everybody listening, but maybe new to some people listening. Say hello, buddy. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. You have a killer journey, and I'm excited to dive into this journey. So why don't we get started? Tell me a little bit about your journey and how you got here so people listen and have sort of a background on you, and tell us what you're up to now, because you're back in the world getting dirty, so to speak.
That's true. I'll give the semi-long version of how I got here, because I think it's weird. Like so many of us, I started in construction, worked for a number of companies, you know, Walsh, McCarthy, and at McCarthy is the first place my BIM journey started. I came out of the field after 8 or 9 years. So I worked up being a project engineer, superintendent. Then I got into the BIM side of things. I worked my way up on the BIM ladder at McCarthy. And then that's what Kiewit originally hired me for almost 10 years ago. Then I went over to Kiewit. So I worked in their VDC group back in 2013. And at some point, I decided that consulting was a good way to go. And that's really what kicked off a very interesting journey, because I left Kiewit and I went to HDR, where I had like my own line of BIM consulting, where I did BIM consulting for owners. And then I ended up going back to Kiewit, working for Innate, where we were working on the creation of a BIM product for the Innate, being the software company that Kiewit owns. But from there, I went back to HDR, where I became their transportation BIM program manager, which was, you know, focused on working with all the transportation clients worldwide, understanding their BIM needs and making sure to, you know, communicate that back to HDR. And then one day Procore came along and asked me to come over there and help with the development of their BIM product. So I went over there as a product manager. And now I'm back at Kiewit a third time. And, you know, the major driver for why I'm back at Kiewit, I think, is the infrastructure bill. This is my theory, right? Because I think that the infrastructure bill allowed a lot of the transportation owners to throw in the things that used to get thrown out because they thought it was extra. And one of those things, I think, was technology, BIM requirements. When that infrastructure bill was there and people were, you know, were kind of flush with money, they got to ask for those things. And a company like Kiewit saw these requirements coming through on their projects and realized, you know, that they needed, you know, someone who could help them manage those requirements on transportation jobs. And so back I came.
Back UK. So that's a great run. And I have to say it, third time's a charm, right? Come on.
It's yep. Too
easy. I mean, you threw me a hanging curveball, man. I had to take that one. But honestly, I wanna just take a second and kind of break down the run you've had of, you know, so you have field focus experience. You really know how things get built. You go into the office, you learn how to digitally build it. And, you know, I know from working with McCarthy, that's, you know, pretty core to their way of doing things, right? That they've made that part of their DNA. And I think that, you know, does some gives you some powerful experience, but then you go to the other side, the quote unquote dark side, and learn how it's built and go back and forth a little bit. Talk to me about how that's helped you with understanding BIM tools and understanding what works and where things, where products might be in the process. I think you'll have a very interesting and unique take on that. And then I want to talk about how we get this involved with the IIJA and everything there with getting the stuff, you know, in a place where it's just not really been predominant. But I like your reasoning for that, by the way, Connor. Good on you for like this has been thrown out because like, well, the other things, you know, were the things you can't throw out. You can throw out the technology. You can't throw out the materials, the people, you know. And so I know that was a lot. You know, start with, you know, kind of walking a line on both sides there and what it's taught you about the tools.
The more interesting part when you go into the software side is how it's not as flexible as you might think when you're not on the software side, right? Like when you're sitting there doing the work, you're like, these guys can just do anything, right? I'm going to go and I'm going to tell them my great ideas and then they should just do them. And when you first jump over, and so this is a good lesson for, I know a lot of people in technology who want to make that jump. They're like, I want to become a product manager. I want to help build these products. And you get over to the other side and the first thing is like, you're jazzed up because you're like, now I'm going to give them all my ideas and they're going to become realities. And then that doesn't really happen, right? There's a lot of reasons why it doesn't work like that. You know, there's tech debt, you know, ways that the program's already built. And maybe the idea that you had doesn't really fit in very well. There's also a different world of kind of understanding in what people are looking for in software versus, I think, what people are really looking for as customers. And I'll give an example. The idea that you might throw something out there where you say, okay, I just want to give people the ability to do X, Y, or Z. Now, I would say that knowing full well that the people in our industry in construction they're very good at doing many things. And they love to take tools and figure out how they work and figure out how to apply them. And to me, I always believed there was some amount of reliance you can have on that industriousness of this market sector. But in the software world, for folks that are just like, I'm going to say pure software, right? They don't, they know software. They don't know construction. They feel like they need to go an extra step of, well, you can't just like give people data, right? You have to give them the ability. You have to like finish the equation for them. And my feeling was, you know, always like, okay, if you just give them the data, they'll figure it out. But a lot of times, you know, people are locked away from their data. And so they're not able to get it. And so there was always that kind of like disconnect. Like in the software world, you don't just give someone data. You have to finish it. You have to give them data, but for what? For quantity takeoff? Okay, well, then let's make a quantity takeoff tool that does it all for them. So like, it was really interesting to see how software people want to get to this place where they're helping people to the very endpoint of their problems. And sometimes my general feeling was that sometimes that gets in the way. Sometimes what you really need to do is get them halfway there and let them finish it on their own because they can.
So I 100%, I like, I'm making the connection here and everything. So I mean, especially construction, this world, we're problem solvers. Literally, yeah. Our jobs are every day there's a new problem. How do we figure out how to solve it? Where the software is literally trying to provide a solution to just about any problem, a specific problem, or trying to say, hey, we can provide solutions to a lot of problems, but they never do. Where you're talking about really, hey, let's just give them a resource that's going to elevate their ability to problem solve even quicker and get there quicker because they're going to be able to do that. That's their job. That's what we do on a day-to-day basis where other industries aren't like that. That's, I don't know if, you know, finance is like, no, I need a solution. I need a pinpoint solution that does X, Y, and Z for me because if not, I can't do my job.
No, that's exactly right. And, you know, contractors, we'll use a tool to solve our problems one way or the other.
Oh, yeah.
just put it in our hands.
It's a really unique. I've never had anybody really talk about it that way, Connor, and I kind of dig it because it's that it's very agile in its approach in what you're thinking, and it's kind of funny because you'd think software, pure software, would understand that because agile is about, you know, that they call it the MVP. I like to call it the MLP, the minimum lovable product that I can do something with. But they stretch that it's never done. But you're right, they don't really just like trust the end user in many cases. And I think construction being such a complex environment, it's the perfect place. And Jacob, you're right. Like, they are problem solvers. I will argue though that they will tell you, and I think quite vehemently, maybe we should, you know, have less problems. We shouldn't have to solve them every day, but that doesn't mean that they don't love a good problem and love a good puzzle. And giving them the data, they can figure out, you know, how to make the puzzle and where the edges of the puzzle are. And then the software team can come in and put wrappers around it for maybe some of those folks that can't do that. So that's pretty awesome. I think people are going to love that little nugget you just gave them. Jacob?
I think that's downfall of a lot of products, though. A lot of software products try to be that pinpoint solution. And Jeff, we've even talked about this, is you can't have 50 products out there. That's where you have your tech burnout. If you have 50 products deployed across your team just to solve this problem and this problem and this problem, it just becomes too much. People give up, throw them away. And so it's a matter of, you know, building that platform of, hey, this is a resource. You can use it, make your job easier, and you can go keep problem solving. I think we've like hit a home run in the first 20 minutes of this, guys. This is fantastic.
This is a good one. This is a good one. So now I want to you know, we call that, you know, you've now seen how the sausage is made and you're still willing to go and eat the sausage. So you're out there using it now. So talk about, like, this has to be really cool with, you know, the infrastructure bill coming out and the influx of money and some of that even focused on technology. Talk about how that's really forming your job.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's the transportation industry. And this is, again, I went through my career there, but it's important to note that the beginning of my career was in transportation when I was with Walsh. And then I went over to buildings and I worked on hospitals and I worked on federal projects. And now I've come back to working in transportation again. And so, like, seeing those things, you know, through the lens of technology and how they change. Like when I was at Walsh, I was on one of the first projects they were ever, where they actually used GPS on one of their dozers to cut grade down on the Dan Ryan in Chicago. And that was over 20 years ago. And that was so cool at the time, right? Like, cause I did field layout. I was literally, when I was there, I started with a regular total station. And when I finished working with Walsh, I was using, you know, GPS poles. So I kind of like saw that transition. And that was like just such cool technology to me. And I was like, this stuff is just going to change everything. But then I ended up switching out of transportation and I went into the building side. And there wasn't, you know, at the time, you know, early 2000s, it wasn't a ton of technology really happening, not the way that we see it now, for sure. And then, you know, BIM came around and then I got excited again. But to see, you know, some of the things that changed that, right? Revit changed that. Navisworks changed that. A lot of times it is the tools that show up and people say, I am now capable of more. How do I apply this? And I saw that happen in buildings. And I personally believe that the reason that a lot of transportation has really picked up with this had to do with those tools changing for transportation, I would say in the late 20 teens. Certainly one thing you can point to is the development of Bentley's open platform. Because going from inroads to open roads, I'm going to liken that to the world we're going from AutoCAD to Revit for buildings. We're truly moving into the model-based parametric workflows. And I'm going to say off the top of my head, I may be wrong on the date here, but that was in around 2017, 2018 that showed up. And then there's been some time for people to get used to it in transportation, just because, you know, they have to create their Bentley workspaces and they just kind of have to get used to it and start requiring it. But now you're seeing this by now, many of this, the DOTs are rolling out ORD workspaces, expecting ORD deliverables. And that is, you know, it's very exciting for us because, like the building world, once you have a model, and this is why I love models, is it gives you options. When you got a set of drawings, all you can do is read it. When you have a model, you can cut a set of drawings, or you can do clash detection, or you can do 4D, or you can do quantity takeoffs. You know, you got options. And that's what I'm seeing now and getting to leverage is, okay, now we're in the transportation space and we get to start leveraging those options for folks. But the transportation industry took to it like no industry like I've ever seen. They were so into it. The DOTs is in particular, watching how excited they were about it has been interesting to watch. And I got to be in a really lucky position. When I was at HDR, you know, working with owners and then working specifically with transportation owners, I got to, you know, be in the rooms at AASHTO as they were, you know, talking about the decisions that they wanted to make. And listen to them, you know, making the decisions like, oh, we want to do this. We want to do all of the modeling. We want to have, model-based deliverables, model as a legal document. And it was like at the point where me as a technology consultant, I was like, hey, maybe you guys want to slow down a little bit.
It's interesting you talk about that transition and that pickup. And because of actually, I will say, I mean, we're doing work right now with Bentley stuff, and it's different. It's a whole different beast. My company is a BIM-based company, but that meant Revit for so many years, right? Like that's what we knew. And now we're starting to learn this, you know, whole open building ecosystem. But the thing was, when BIM was in this vertical space, this vertical construction space between, you know, 2005 to 2015, all the hype was around that. But the BIM products that were there couldn't do infrastructure. You ask it to do a mile long piece of infrastructure and the product just breaks. Like it wasn't even a solution for them to even try. So I'm sure sitting around in DOTs and seeing, you know, vertical construction go and talk about all these cool things, I think it's really neat how Bentley did jump at that opportunity, really pushed it out back in 2017-ish. And then now they really are. They got DOTs requiring this. It is a digital delivery base of, hey, we're going to do the work from now on. And maybe it was the infrastructure bill that has pushed it, but now it's a requirement. And that's, we're seeing a lot of that as it doesn't matter what the money's going to be doing in the future, but the next set of projects, yeah, it's still going to be a requirement on that.
I think the infrastructure bill helped it. Because everybody was gearing up. They were getting ready. They were having those requirements written. I mean, that was a lot of my previous role was helping them write requirements and figure out what their path forward was. And all they were waiting for was something to help them kick that into gear. And I think that infrastructure bill does that.
Everyone supports a culture of well-being in the field and is equipped with the tools to help prevent suicide in construction. Procore Safety Qualified courses were built in partnership with our customers, elevating enhancements to their standard OSHA training. And the Bringing the Right Mindset series equips individuals and leaders alike with the skills necessary to really build resilient teams. We've made these three courses available for free and on demand, and they're offered both in English as well as Spanish, and they are CEU certifiable. Procore.com/certified-qualified is where we host our Procore's learning portal, and anyone can use their Procore credentials or create a free account to get started.
So you hit a couple things. I'm gonna try to go BIM nerd here. So I know a lot about the opportunities, the clash detection, the things you can do in vertical, right, with BIM, right? Because we've had a lot of people on the show, not because I know how to do it, because I've watched over a lot of shoulders, worked with a lot of mechanicals over the years. What in the world are those opportunities in horizontal construction in what you're doing? Like, what is the light bulbs that are going off? What are some of the particular things you're actually doing? Because, man, I don't know. So this is a great one for me to like lean in and be stupid, because, well, I get to be the dumb one. So let's do it. What are some of those opportunities? What is it gonna, how is it going to change the horizontal construction?
I think the first step is understanding how different construction is in transportation from buildings. I mean, you're looking at a world where most of the work is self-performed, where that puts this very strong focus on productivity and on quantities. So I'll put that off right now as part of it. Another part of it is just how projects are thought about. You know, we think about buildings in terms of this floor, this area, this this location on a grid. Well, there is no grid in on a road. Instead, what you have are alignments. And a lot of, like, when you look at a set of drawings on a roadway, what you have are cross sections on that roadway. So you got a plan view, but then you have a lot of cross sections. Those cross sections, you know, tell you a lot of what's going on, but there can be a lot of distance between different cross sections. And the way it was done in the past is someone would have to stop and draw each of those cross sections. And so, like, the more detailed design you had, the more cross sections you had with less space between them. Okay. And literally to the point where, like, designers used to be paid by how many sheets they would make, right? Like, we're going to do 100 cross sections. We're going to do 1,000 cross sections, whatever. So in the world of BIM, you can cut a cross section anywhere you want, right? That's very different. That's a different world. And, you know, there's some really cool tools out there. I'm going to, you know, hype Bentley a little bit again here. You know, their iTwin product, where you're able to just run down an alignment and anywhere you want, cut a cross section, and it shows it to you. And you're able to, you know, look at all the values that you need there in order to understand that design. Like, that's really good stuff. So there is no like, oh, can you cut me a cross section at this? I don't understand what's going on. Cause you'd have to do that as a contractor from time to time. Like, hey, these services are come together at a weird angle. I don't get it. Cut me a cross section. So now, I mean, I can cut that anywhere I want. And that's pretty amazing. So that's just kind of one piece. But then I talked about productivity and quantities. And that's where I like to lean into, because that's kind of, it's kind of everything to contractors. So just the ability to take quantities off and understand how that affects your production. I mean, it's something that they do every day anyways, but to be able to quantify that more quickly, to really understand what your quantities are. I mean, we all know how that is. When I was an intern at Walsh, I mean, I used to go out every day, and with my tape measure, I would like measure how much rebar was installed, or how much concrete, or, you know, how much dirt. Like, I'd just be out there measuring all day so I could come back and be like, yeah, this is, you know, how many square foot of this retaining wall we put in. It was... And that would be like my whole day, just out there measuring stuff. Where now I could be like, oh, I clicked on that and checked it off as done. That's a 2-second operation.
Technology taking jobs away from the field.
From the hardworking interns.
Yeah, hardworking interns everywhere are not upset about this. I will tell you that right now. Like, wow, I didn't have to go crawl around through all of that. Not that I would and measure and probably not write down my measurements. Well, that's not so bad.
Now, I'm also, if you get to know me well, you'll know that I'm obsessed with data. And there's a wonderful part about DOTs, and that is that they all operate off of something called pay items. Now, with other facility owners, they don't always know what the things are or classify the things that represent their projects. So when you ask them, like, hey, what is it that's important to you? You know, and, you know, what are all the things that, you know, you want me to report back to you about? You know, if it's asset management, for instance, most of them don't have a real solid answer, but the DOTs do. And a lot of people would be surprised at how technologically advanced DOTs really are, because you don't really think about it and you don't think about how much they track. But like every guardrail, every sign. So yeah, everywhere that there's like, you know, you see the signs for like loose or sliding rock, you know, like all of that is tracked. They've got it all. And all of it is classified. So for me, that's like just an awesome data exercise, because you can go to any state and go get their pay items, you know, download it off the internet. It's all publicly available, and it'll be 10,000 things that represents what they want to build. And for every one of those pay items, there's a corresponding specification with the same number. And then when you're a contractor, when you go to bill, you bill by your pay items. I want to get paid. That's why they're called pay items. I want to get paid by this. So there's this organization to what they do that doesn't exist in the building world that is very conducive to BIM-based workflows, because the data already, they've made it so it kind of connects. You know, I won't say that it's perfect. There's you know, things we can do to help that along, but it certainly is better than nothing.
As a BIM nerd and a data nerd myself, that, I mean, you basically have a data taxonomy that then you can apply all sorts of tools to, and that's what technology is great at, right? It's an accelerant, but you've got to have a framework. People forget that, you know, and yeah. Man, that just seems like some powerful ways to get paid, get productive, get visible over what you're doing. Now I know why you're back in and you were so excited to get going.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. You see those opportunities like, hey, we get to do some really cool stuff here. And so while transportation, I think, in terms of its BIM application, had started later than buildings, what they're trying to do with it is just kind of blowing by what buildings were doing, the building industry. And you know, a big part of that, and I really want to highlight this, is research. Because I don't even know what the number's up to, but I'm going to say it's well over $30 million in just research on how to do or apply the BIM process has been put in place by transportation entities, you know, in the last 5 to 10 years. And that's only growing. A great example. Again, this is part of the infrastructure bill, is the FHWA has these ACDMS, I think the acronym is, grants. And if you look, they released the first 10 of those grants last year. And those grants are all about either BIM or data/asset management in some way, shape, or form. And that's really telling, because these are some of the biggest technology grants, and they have to be for technology. I mean, we're talking states getting $5 million grants on just researching technology. And you know, to throw that out there, there's the size of the projects in this are pretty crazy. The, you know, I used to work on the BIM for Bridges and Structures Pooled Fund. That was a project I had when I was at HDR, and it's still ongoing. HDR is still leading it. But it was, at the time, I think 23 or 24 states pooled their money together to investigate how BIM can be used to help bridges and structures. And that was, you know, $2.5 million Then another pooled fund was put together that is BIM for Infrastructure pooled fund. I think that's almost $5 million. Then Pennsylvania put out a project, the Digital Delivery Directive 2025. That was, and I'm starting to forget the numbers now because I've been away for too long, but you know, that was a $5 or $10 million project. Texas has something similar. Caltrans has something similar. And when we were at IHEAP this last year, which is a big transportation kind of technology conference, the number of states coming out and talking about how they are releasing these kinds of contracts was, it was amazing to me. Just the amount of money that they're putting into figuring it out. They're not, you know, it's when you spend that much money, you're going to learn something. Because you're gonna get the professionals to show up and just and do that work, so it's very impressive to see in the transportation industry, and it's why I think they'll kind of go by the building industry pretty quickly.
It's pretty obvious though. I think you're right. I think they're gonna, you know, the steam train right on by us, you know, just bullet train right on by, because honestly they did the work ahead of time. Right. Almost the tools not being there early and focusing on the taxonomy and focusing on the things they could focus on and having and also, you know, to give the building side some love, having a very different product and a very different process. You know, you like you said, most of them self-perform. When you talk to self-perform contractors, you do hear a lot more about the power of BIM. That's why mechanicals and electricals do so much BIM, because they are doing the work. So, you know, again, the fragmentation, but also, man, I love that research angle. We've covered a couple of those over time, Connor, but I think you just dug deeper into why they're so important and just how many of them are out there to advance it. And it's probably because they've seen the results of it in pockets. So if you see results, I think that's one of the things in building it. In what I'm learning now from you is that, you know, roads and bridges and these types of things are, I wouldn't call them standard, but they're very similar across the board. You have lots of DOTs at the state level, but they have all the same problems. They have contractors that cross the borders and work in different areas, and there's a consistency. So that does not exist in building because, well, it's a much more diverse world that way. So, but man, research can really drive it forward. Jacob, you got a question? Are you a construction company that's inundated with applications? Are you struggling to get technology adoption? Are you worried you're creating data silos? We refer to that as gray work. You want to learn more about gray work and how leading construction companies are getting past it? Then join me at QuickBase's Empower 2024. Go to quickbase.com/empower.
Yeah. So I think the other thing with the infrastructure side is the project size and the project costs actually allow more to be done on the project. So if you look at a vertical building, even large projects on the vertical side, you basically have to pick and choose what you can do with BIM. And it's really about what gets you the most value. So most of the time it comes down to this class coordination idea. Hey, we're going to do class coordination. We're going to make sure we don't run into problems in the field. But then you present, hey, what if we do a little bit more? It's going to cost more, but we're going to get quantities out of it. We already have a model. Let's try. Well, what's the real value to them? They don't really, half the time, they don't see the actual value comparison. Meanwhile, if you go to this big project of infrastructure, the additional cost is minimal compared to the project side, but the value then comes so much bigger to them. To actually come through and actually use the BIM, like you were talking earlier, is you can do so much more with it on that infrastructure side. Getting quantities out of it, it's infinite more value on that. Doing clash coordination is great. It might not be the main point of it, but still you're removing problems from the field. And it kind of just keeps going where your ability to actually say, yes, let's go ahead and add the additional cost because it's a drop compared to the whole project, but we're actually using that BIM to the full potential. And I think that's really cool. I think your self-performing GCs, like we were talking about before, do see it more and more on the vertical side that will be willing to do it. But I think it's really cool how, because that money is there, we have been able to kind of check that box, which it's the amount of, hey, how many times do we try it and see what value we get out of it? But you have to have money to be able to actually get that value, right? No, so yeah. What I'll go from here, though, is, Connor, I mean, we were talking about what we're able to do with BIM right now. We're talking about what the past 10 years has kind of done for infrastructure. What do you see going in the next 10 years? What is like the big leaps that we're going to see with BIM or technology on the infrastructure side?
There's probably two pieces that I'm very interested in. One is the asset management side. There's a huge focus there because the value is so high. And you can see it in the research that's being done. You can see it in what people are asking for. You know, on the infrastructure side, they really want to get their assets, you know, out of the construction process into their databases, start maintaining them on day one, for all the reasons that doing that is good. But I see that coming through the BIM process. And there's a big push for that. So I think that's something to watch. Another thing that I think that you're not seeing as much of, but I think is inevitable, is more generative design. That is a lot more common in buildings, and it does not so much exist on the transportation side. I will say I've seen good examples of it, but the truth is that in the building world, there are tools that, you know, generate design tools that help them along in the current processes and tools of the transportation world. There's not as many generative design tools, and there's even less people that kind of know how to use the ones that do exist. But the power of using generative design within transportation, I believe, is much too strong to, you know, let that go. Yeah, so much of transportation is really just the rules of what you're building. And while that's kind of true in buildings, you also have architects, right? Like how the building looks and whatnot ends up being a little bit different, where on a road, it's really just, you know, it's really just math.
So you're saying that it's going to be a computer that turns engineers into more creative people?
That's one way to look at it, Jacob. I like that.
So, and for people that are sitting here listening and thinking, what would generative design in infrastructure, roads, tunnels, bridges look like? What would that entail?
Yeah, like I said, it's really just math and codes and standards that define what your bridge is going to be, or what your road is going to be, and how tight this curve is supposed to be, and what the crown and the road is supposed to be. If you're able to, you know, use some sort of a generative design program where you put all those tolerances in and have that start to generate geometry for you, where you know, no matter what, it's always going to fit those requirements. And then you just start to tweak the few parameters that you can tweak in order to, you know, get things going. The speed with which that design will get done would be untouchable. And there'd be a lot less, you know, like I said, in a building, there's going to be a lot of other things to consider, like, what about this function or this adjacency, or, you know, the way that this looks or how this lighting is, you know, like that doesn't happen as much on roads. I'll say this maybe a little bit, but not nearly as much as in buildings. So it is a whole lot more programmable. And so I think that is an inevitability in the transportation space.
I'll go one further, Connor. I think given just how you've described it and understanding what AI does and how it does it, and generative AI, is that it needs to be fed rules. It needs to be fed, and it does great at things like math. And that's what you're talking about. I think it'll go one level higher, where we can actually start to feed it our requirements from a human standard of, we need this many cars or people to pass through these areas, and it will give us ways we never thought of it before. It will produce things for us because it knows because those things are so tight, right? Because those rules, that's what generative AI is great at. When there is really concrete rules, you can abstract more and more above it and start to feed it ideas. Like, we just think about building roads and bridges, right? And we just think, and we assume certain things are just what they are. Computers don't make those same assumptions. So if we can abstract out and start to feed it things, we might look at how we build our cities, how we connect things, and what we actually produce extraordinarily differently. And I'm just, dude, you got me nerding out on this one, because that is just, I mean, I didn't realize how just perfect for that world it is. And it's the perfect time for it now too, because like you said, it's going to start with, hey, I got a set of parameters. Hey, do it for me. It's going to be rapidly produced. But what that does is take, you know, everybody thinks AI is going to take the job. It's not going to take the job. What it's going to do is elevate the person who used to take all the time making sure that geometry, making sure all of that was right. And it's going to elevate them to think, ooh, all right, what else can I do? And if I can do 1,000 things, try 1,000 things virtually.
That
I only need one.
That second piece, I think, is really important, that trying lots of things. You know, it's always interesting to me when, you know, there's conversations where people are like, well, with all this technology and the BIM stuff, you know, is that increasing the speed of design? And my answer is like, well, why would it? Because the designers would never stop, really, if nobody made them. Because
that's true.
Because they're just trying to iterate and iterate and iterate till they get to the perfect solution. So when you have the technology, that's not making the design get done faster. It's given the ability to iterate more. So what you should get is a higher quality design in a period of time. Not, I mean, like technically, I guess you could just cut them off faster at some point and have a lower quality design, but nobody wants that, hopefully.
I would say, yeah, I like that. Add the hopefully there, because I'm sure there's a few out there that do. But well, man, listen, I'm gonna end it there, because that is a mic drop. And man, I mean, it had been a while since we run into each other. I'm so excited, Jacob, that you brought Connor over to catch up on what you're doing. Where can people go learn more about what you're up to, you know, get involved with the Connor world? Sounded like you were going to be somewhere soon. So maybe plug where you're going to be soon.
Well, that's true. I guess I'll be speaking at DBIA Transportation Conference in Cincinnati. That's always a good place to find me.
All right.
And I know that some other good things that'll be out there. Honestly, one of my favorites that I always have to give a plug for is IHEAP. It's a little known conference, but it's so important to the transportation industry. And that's IHEEP, International Highway Engineering Exchange Program.
That's a new one I'm going to add to my list, man. I want to sneak into that one. You got me geeking out, man. I found a whole new world to geek out on. So
it is my favorite conference I go to every year.
And that's saying a lot, because the man has been to a lot of conferences over the years with all those different companies, all that different BIM work, all that. You've been to a lot of conferences. So that's a big stamp coming from Connor. Back in 2020, I heard about a new software platform called Join. Within minutes of seeing Join, I knew it had the power to revolutionize collaborative project delivery. In fact, I was so sold on Join that I joined the team as its industry evangelist. Many trade shows and podcasts later, Join is now used by 50% of the ENR top 30. Why? Pre-con and ops leaders at DPR, Bolt, McCarthy, Barton Mallow, Clark, and others say that they like Join because it does two big things: collaborative, trackable decision-making, and awesomely simple visuals. Want to learn more about the power of Join? Go to www.join.build/demo to learn about how better gets built. All right, Jacob, you know what's next. We got to get into the construction technology news of the week. What do you got for us, buddy?
All right, so news of the week. I'm gonna do this one here for the individuals that do listen weekly. And if you were listening to the podcast that we just did, that Jeff and I just did with Ian Theodore, we had a lot of conversation about IT infrastructure, about the role it's playing and sustainability and everything. And I found this article, which is, oh man, it literally came out yesterday. It's over UK. We'll look at it a little from England, but it's PBC Today. and it's actually the crucial role of smart IT in the construction industry's ESG journey. Now, it's not as much actually the construction industries, but it talks about the role of IT infrastructure and sustainability in what we are using today. So as we continue building out all these ESG goals, everything we're doing, buildings are getting smarter. We had this whole conversation last episode, and we talked about how the infrastructure for IT infrastructure is growing per building over and over again. It talks about how much it is causing the ESG or causing carbonization. It's causing all these different sustainability things to go up, with enterprise technology accounting for around 1% of global emissions. So all this IT infrastructure actually accounts for 1% of global emissions. Now you got to think about that. It's now growing more and more and more. So the more data centers we put in, the more infrastructure we put in each building is adding to these global emissions. And it puts that one of the areas that we could really find good ESG revolution is outdated IT systems. So owners, if you're trying to hit ESG goals, you can actually go back and find outdated IT systems, update them so they're more efficient, they're not as much as a global emission, you know, problem, and then that actually feeds your ESG goals. So the article goes through and actually has practical steps, actually has ideas on how this looks, and it actually gives you some statistics on how to link it to your ESG scorecards. So awesome, awesome article. I loved it. Jeff, what do you think?
You know me, I'm a IT nerd at heart. So this was awesome because I will combat this a little bit and come at it from a little bit of a different angle here. One thing, and Tanis Liviniak and I've talked about this a lot, data is not free. Okay. And data has a carbon impact. And so yes, we're getting better at storing it in dark methods and not taking up as much energy, but data for the sake of data is not a good thing. And so we should really understand that there is a cost to that long term. So people need to start thinking about that a little bit. But I don't also want to drive people away from storing data. And I think while, yes, we're growing that footprint when you think about data centers, if we switch our mindsets, data centers are and can be optimized, right? Far more than all of these devices that we all carry around or run in our houses or have local, right? They're much more power efficient. They can add new technologies to be more green, but you have to be able to leverage them. So using things like DaaS, desktop as a service, using things like IaaS, infrastructure as a service, starting to switch your mindset in, I don't need to have it, they need to have it, and I need to know how to provide it to my people at much less cost and much less impact on our ESG scores is phenomenal. If we can produce lower quality laptops, you know, not so much crap in them, because the power is living in the data center, it does a number of different things. It's highly more secure, first of all, and security should be at the top of everybody's minds. So you can get more secure and more green by using modern IT infrastructure to deploy. And also then, you know, this is also about smart IT and smart devices in understanding and capturing information passively to know your impacts. So, dude, I'm all about it. I think it is fantastic. And I'm also a fan of go over your IT infrastructure, because, you know, some of that stuff's killing you way more than you realize. Like the $20,000 for the new switch or whatnot, the amount of quickly that will pay itself back is phenomenal. And that just might be in an experiential payback for people using it. So Connor, I'm interested, man, because like the BIM world goes through this, like, take it to the cloud, bring it back to local. Take it to the cloud, bring it back to local is what we've seen and the sine curve. So I'm interested in your take on this, you know, IT and smart IT.
Like anything that helps me make arguments for people, you know, increasing or moving forward their IT infrastructure. Can't tell you how often that's a limitation on what it is we're trying to achieve. So for me, just like, yeah, send me that article, because I'm going to be putting that right in front of people. Like, here's another good reason You know, it's not just good for your business, but it's good for the environment. I think that's a strong reason to be putting that out there. So that's one thing that jumps out at me.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Jacob, all right, man, what else you got for us today?
So my next one is a little marketing thing from Purdue University, which I know Connor is going to enjoy. And actually, Purdue University to launch Trimble Technology Lab with focus on construction management technology. Hey, this is right down the contact crew's alley right here. We love to see this. So Trimble definitely made a little bit of a donation to Purdue University, but said, hey, we need a lab. We want to test construction management technology. We want to play around with things. Purdue, you're the perfect spot for it. I love seeing it. It's supposed to open early this year. I can't wait to see what comes out of it. I love the idea of testing and doing things through school, doing things with students and the education side. I'm excited.
I'll throw it out there. I am a little biased as I went to Purdue. I was in their construction engineering management program, which I think is the best in the world. In case anyone's looking for a good program, that's the one. And, you know, one of the reasons I thought it was because our access to resources and the facilities at Purdue are just second to none. It was so amazing being there. And so to see them continuing to do this, you know, building these, you know, labs for their students to work in and learn from is, well, it's just so much what Purdue does. So very excited to see that article.
Yeah, I'm excited too, Jacob. You know, this gets me going because I think the greatest place for the future minds to think about how they can impact our world is in, you know, labs like this at universities, right? You hear us talk a lot about the path of trade and that not everybody needs to go to college. That's never to say that we don't need higher education, that we don't need that involvement. It's that we need a diversity of involvement and a pathway that's not the traditional for everybody. But we need these facilities. And good on it for Trimble. This is not only great for the future of construction, it's great for Trimble.
Yeah.
Right. This is an opportunity for them to improve their products, to learn from the future, to be prepared. And I'll be honest, create attics on the way out. That's why 100%. Microsoft sold their licensing to schools for dirt cheap. The first time I ever did a school project as a consultant and was, you know, pricing it out, they're like, oh, here, we have the school pricing. And I was like, are you for real? This is so cheap. And the guy I was working with turned to me and goes, yeah, you give it to them cheap so that they come out and they ask for Excel and Office and, you know, other and Outlook and other things like that. And I was like, oh, that's pretty unique. So it makes great business sense for Trimble in the long run as well. And I just can't even imagine the different cool things they can do there. So awesome stuff, man. Connor, what you got?
So I'm gonna spin that a little because you brought up something very interesting, which is the trades. And you know, in my experience, I spent, I think it was almost 3 years working with the United Brotherhood of Carpenters, helping them to write their BIM training for all the carpenters in the US and Canada. I would actually challenge places like Trimble to remember that there is a group of people out there that are not going to college, but still need to learn these things. So just as much as you give to those universities, don't forget to give to those trades, to those unions, because they need to learn these things too. And there's my plug.
Man, I love this. Connor's hitting all our audience out there, man. Way to go, man. You can just come on anytime you want, buddy. That's awesome. All right. Well, I guess it's time for me and you know, I'm gonna shift us from the IT into the interesting touchy-feely, but I like data. And so this one's a LinkedIn post, but it's also an article, and it's from A Spark of Optimism. One of my favorite authors, Simon Sinek, who I am, you know, absolutely obsessed with the things he has to teach us. And I'm obsessed with organizational psychology. And this was a great one because the article is, should you tell your employees not to work on weekends? And if you've been following him, he's big on work-life balance. You know, I'm big on work-life balance. And this conversation got really interesting because he himself is, you know, Simon is huge with his team on, you know, work-life balance and when they have to go hard and say work a Saturday, giving them another day off And, you know, even to the point of reaching out to employees that send late night emails, et cetera, and saying, hey, like, you know, you need to be with your family. You need that time. And he hired some people to look at the data from water cooler. And it was so cool to see that what water cooler. So this is really cool, by the way. I've reached out to water cooler and I want to talk to them more because they've created machine learning to look for anomalies in company workflow to predict the risk of burnout. And in doing so, and truth be told, Simon's on the board for water cooler. And what it turned out was there's these areas of high risk and they are overlaid in this graph with percentage of weekend and vacation days interrupted by work. And it actually turns out that there's this sweet spot between 20 and 40% of your weekends and your vacation days interrupted is actually a really safe zone for employees to be in. And the correlation was it shows their dedication. It shows that they are driven and engaged. And it so by him telling them, don't do this, you know, don't work, he was actually telling them, don't be engaged, don't be passionate. So he had to say, hey, there's these areas where it can go past being healthy. But hey, you're engaged, so I actually should just make sure I check in on you and I should rethink this problem of people working after hours or being interrupted. And so I love a good data chart and I love a good technology around it. So it was really, really cool. I'm interested, Jacob, to hear, you know, what are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, so I got three things on this. And this is all coming personally from my experience in the world. I'm a workaholic. I'm constantly engaged. If you don't know me, then I am very passionate about what I do. I love what I do. I do it all the time. But I will say there are a couple things here that I think works really well. First, catching up on stuff weekends and at night. We're busy. We're so busy. My day is back-to-back meetings. To be able to sit down for an hour at night or an hour on the weekend, catch up on emails, get ahead of it, and know Monday morning I'm caught up moving forward is a peace of mind that I can't get back. It is so perfect for me to then feel calm, collected. I'm okay. I'm approaching the next week just fine. I think a lot of people have that. And to remove stress from employees, to remove this idea of constantly feeling like you're underwater. If they need to do this, let them. That's great. Let's keep doing that. Second, on vacations. So that vacation's part of that too, right? It says, hey, maybe 20, 40% engagement on vacations. If you are on vacation and feel like you're too disengaged and something is going to go wrong and you're not going to relax, you're not going to enjoy it. Some people can't disconnect in that way and just walk away for the week. I'm one of those people. I like to know. I would like to see the emails are still happening. I'm not going to engage myself to the point that I'm losing my vacation time. But for my peace of mind, to know that it's okay. I like it. I see it. Point three, vice versa. As a manager, I have actually found out me working, sending emails on a holiday has caused stress for my employees. They feel like they're not doing the right thing because they're not working on the holidays. So I have actually realized, I was like, but that's my way of catching up. That's my way of knowing I'm going to be okay going back in the next day. I realized, well, that's actually sending a little reverse psychology to my employees that like, oh crap, Jacob's working and I should respond to these emails then. And really it's a communication thing at that point. Guys, that was for me. I don't have any expectations from anybody else. I'm sorry if that's what it came across, but that's how I catch up. And maybe it's something that I schedule for them to go out the next morning so it doesn't fall on my employees, but it is. So I wanted those 3 points because they hit me. And I'm like, personally, I've been through this my whole career of like, how do I juggle it?
I love the self-reflection of being a leader and understanding how your actions affect somebody else's. And I think that's what Simon is learning there. Before I throw it to Connor, I was going to say, Jacob, that is why Slack added the delayed send. You can schedule the send. That's why Outlook has it. Google has it. It really is so that like you can get the peace of mind and do all of those things, but not interrupt other people, because there also are people under your tutelage that no matter how much you tell them, if that pops up in Slack, they are going to check it. It's because they're obsessive about it, because they're engaged. So some cool tools. Connor, I'm wondering what you're thinking on that one.
All right. So there's like, you know, the split sides of my brain. There's the one which jumps out automatically, which is like the human side. Like, yeah, that sounds great. You know, whatever is really helping people with manage their stress, I think that's important. Work-life balance is important. And then there's like the technical managerial side where I'm like, okay, was the study done with people who are hourly and make like time and a half on the weekends? because in construction, you know, those things matter. You don't work people on the, you know, you tell them no, because I ain't got it in the budget. It's kind of more for that than stress. But that was kind of the other side that jumped in my head was, you know, are these people salary or are they time and a half on the weekends, or and how does that affect things? I don't know.
You know what? It's interesting because I believe the study was done with salaried employees, not hourly employees. So I think you're right. I think it, and I think the platform itself is focused on over 100 employees. And I think that's right. I think it's all salaried employees. So it's focused on that, which would make it interesting in the construction world to think about, because you're right, because there's a cost and a gain, right? There are a number of folks out there who like to work 50 hours a week because that time and a half is wonderful. So use it. Well, I am going to move us on one more, and this is a quick one, but this was a fun one. And I got to do this at MEP Innovations, and I saw this post come up from Paul Tatham. Paul, national manager at Diamond at Hilti Great Britain. It's somebody using this new EXO T22 tool balancer that is an addition to the exoskeleton that they've done. And he's, I think it's a saw of some sort, but I got to put it on and put on a heavy piece. So it looks like a crane over your head, and it has a cable that holds the tool. And actually it's really cool because when you do it, like, the whole thing is you put the tool on the ground, everything's disconnected, you put it on, it even allows you to drop the hook to it, catch the hook, bring it up to where it's comfortable, and you can move the tool around, but you can let go. And it stays there and it takes all of the weight off of it. And I'm just loving what Hilti's doing with this augmentation for our workforce. Part of our problems in the industry when it comes to mental health and suicide, et cetera, are because of heavy injuries. This is hard work, and it's until the robot army comes out and can really take over, like we've pontificated on, there's some reality that we need augmentation of our workers and we need to make their lives easier. So I am just absolutely loving this one. Jacob, you got to love a good practical tool, man. I held this thing on. It was awesome.
It's crazy. I love it. It's so cool because you're mentally not going to be, I guess physically you're not going to be as exhausted, but you're also going to be able to work longer. You're not putting that stress on you. You're not like going to go home and like lay on the couch and hurt for the next 6 hours before you have to get up and go do it again. It's so cool to me. I think it's really cool because we even have the cost of it. It's only $2,000. It's like these are things that are now tangible. Like we've talked about it for what, like 5 or 6 years about this stuff coming, right? And now it's this like, oh, that seems actually pretty practical. That seems something that's going to be able to go in and do it. And you just strap on the crane and it picks up. But even the fact is, how is a safety concern of holding a heavy piece of equipment and dropping it? And you have to have steel toe boots on because if you drop it, you don't want to break your toes. Well, now you accidentally drop it, it catches it for you. You're not also worrying about slipping and sweating and boom, oh, you just dropped this huge piece of equipment. I think it's cool.
I'm actually, you just thought of something there too. I can't wait. Hilti, here's an idea for you too. If you can tie it to the tool itself, so if it lets go, you let go, it stops and holds. Man, they're like smart tools. Connor, I'm wondering, because you're into the future of this world. What are you thinking?
Well, anything around safety, anything that increases safety, I'm all for. We've all been out in the field, and safety is so important. It's a dangerous place. So yeah, no, I think that's amazing. It's actually partially surprising that it didn't come out with it sooner. I mean, have you ever worked like with your hands over your head for a long period of time? No, because it's so hard.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, man. That was what the first one was. Like, I put that thing on and I have a permanently separated shoulder, so I can't work over my head. I'm strong, but I can't work over my head for almost any period of time. Put that thing on and I was holding tools up over my head for extended periods of time. It was crazy. And that was just the exoskeleton one. This has that arm on it, man.
Yeah, that where it's lifting stuff. I mean, that is really a fantastic thing. Now on the, you know, more lighthearted flip side, anyone who, you know, is going to be missing those overdeveloped contractor muscles, you know, it's a sad story for them. But
yeah,
they're going to actually, hey, are you imagining a world where these folks have to go to the gym afterwards then?
Yeah, exactly.
can you imagine that when construction sites are like, oh, well, we got to put a gym in. Why? Well, this thing lifts everything for us. Yeah. It's like, wow. All right. That's a problem I'd love to have is that we have to have healthy activity benefits for those employees that are out there in the field doing all the hard work. So, man, this has been so much fun. I am so glad that you came on and that this is how, you know, obviously we record out of order at times. And so this is a Friday and I love, this is how my weekend's going to end, guys. This has been awesome. Connor, thank you so much for coming in and all the things you had to say and just, you know, being open to talking to us for a while.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Jacob, brother, always great to see you. You are now free to move about the weekend.
Sweet. Till next time, Jeff.
Thank you for tuning in today to geek out for our interview with Connor Christian. To read all our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontechcrew.com. This is the Contech Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.